Hello everyone, and welcome to the History and Stuff podcast. Today's episode is called The Making of the Past, and it's a little different than the other episodes I've made earlier, because it will focus on not really a period or a place, it will focus more on a concept, and that concept is how history has been formed, how history has been created itself. And many of our current views of history were formed long after the events, often with nationalistic or religious or other motives. This is almost so common that it's more like the rule than the exception. And examples of this exist from ancient times until modern times, from ancient Egypt to World War II. And I will today go through a few examples, and I will start in chronological order. So let's start with ancient Egypt, one of our earliest civilizations, developing at the same time as the Sumerian states and the Indus Valley civilization. And of course, Egypt has been especially interesting to historians, since we have been able to decipher the hieroglyphs with the help of the Rosetta Stone and other things. The Indus Valley civilization isn't as studied, partly because we can't decipher their hieroglyphs. And one long-lasting misinformation that has survived to this day is that the pyramids were built by slaves. I guess you've all heard that one. And while slavery was definitely widely practiced in ancient Egypt in several different forms, from chattel slavery to bonded labor, there is very strong evidence that the laborers that built the pyramids were not slaves, and that they were actually very well fed and well paid, in contrast with slaves, of course. They were very skilled craftsmen. One reason for this myth could be the idea from the Bible that enslaved Hebrews built the pyramids, which there is very little evidence of, and there isn't really any evidence of it in the Bible either. And the characterization of the Egyptians as cruel masters in the Bibles may also have added to the idea that the Egyptians would use mass slave labor to build these pyramids. But then again, there isn't really that much evidence for it. It's more like speculation. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that we can't really generalize about ancient people, because it's very rarely accurate. And that even if we think that we are similar, we're also in many ways very, very, very different from the people that lived thousands of thousands of years ago. And it's very arrogant to think that we can understand their societies like based on our ideas of them. We probably don't. And their concepts of slavery, as they exist, probably differed quite a bit from our concept of slavery as well. Even if, as I said, slaves in any way didn't help build the pyramids. And if we move on to maybe a lesser misunderstanding, that isn't maybe a misunderstanding, but more of a consequence of historiography, is that in regards to ancient states, but particularly ancient Greece, we tend to talk about them like they are states in the far past, even if they weren't states. Like, we use the words like Greek, Sumerian, or Etruscan to categorize a similar cultural sphere more than a state or a nation. And this can sometimes lead to the misapprehension that that ancient Greece was the same thing as modern Greece, like a state with a unified or somewhat unified people. And of course, the Greek states were very rarely politically unified, fought against each other as much as against outsiders, sometimes fought with outsiders against other Greek-speaking peoples. And they would not really recognize Greece as a state or a nation, as we would understand it today, but it was more like a cultural sphere and people that shared a language. And this can be attributed to nationalistic historiography that sought a unified concept of the nation, which was then backformated into the past. And sometimes people talk about Italy as well, before Italy existed. And of course, Italy was unified in the 1800s. And speaking of Italy before that is really quite inaccurate. There wasn't really either any language that was like Italian. The languages were quite different, actually. And the same thing with French. That's also quite a recent standardized thing. And the regions used to be a lot more independent than we think of them today. And if we move on to the Middle Ages, this is an entire time period that has had a very bad historical reputation. And the fall of the Western Roman Empire, of course, did cause a lot of decrease in population density and monumental architecture and things like that. So it was a very big event that had some negative impacts, if you like, things like big cities and monumental architecture. However, the Roman state didn't really change into the Byzantine Empire in the way we might think. We tend to think of it like the Roman Empire, and then we have the Byzantine Empire. But the state continued to call itself just the Roman Empire, and the citizens called themselves the Romans. In fact, there were people calling themselves Romans all the way almost until the time of the First World War. There were like Greek-speaking peoples that lived in the Ottoman Empire. But that's kind of a sidetrack. And the designation of 476 as the fall of Rome is kind of a useful marker for historians to have a date. But it is by no means a galactic shift between areas in some, that is, eras that is sometimes imagined to be. And so-called barbarians had already sacked Rome several times in the past 100 years. And the Roman army was in large part constituted of barbarians at this time, many of which were even generals, some of which didn't even speak Latin. And the events of 476 were more like a coup against the puppet ruler with limited power than an actual, you know, raising of the empire. It was just that it was formally dissolved. And several Roman provinces also maintained Roman rule for several years after this in so-called rump states. So it can't really be said to be like a definitive end. Because the Byzantine Empire, or the Roman Empire, as they would say, continued on for almost 1,000 years after that as well. But moving on to the Middle Age proper, this time has also been misrepresented in large part by historians of the Renaissance, at least according to me, misrepresented. The view of the period between themselves and the glorious Roman Empire was like a period of stagnation and barbarism. And this view has a very narrow geographical and cultural scope, and I would even argue that even if you look at that narrow scope, it is still quite inaccurate, because there was a lot of things that happened in the Middle Ages that were very, very positive and contributed to the centuries that would come. And of course, you wouldn't have a Renaissance if you didn't have progress that happened during the Middle Ages. During the Middle Ages, slavery was abolished in most of Europe, as something that had been very widespread earlier, and still was kind of widespread in some areas. But it was steadily abolished. And the spread of monasteries also helped increase literacy, and eventually the first universities in Europe started to open. So education became more widespread. The Middle Ages were also significantly less filled with witch trials and religious wars than the following centuries. And there was also increasingly a tendency to establish consistent legal system based on laws like Roman law or legal code, rather than the arbitrary whims of the monarch or inconsistent regional traditions. In Sweden, for example, this is exemplified by the so-called peace laws. We had Hemfrid, Kyrkfrid, Tingsfrid, and Kvinnofrid, which basically made sure that you couldn't engage in violence in someone's home, or you couldn't engage in violence against women, you couldn't engage in violence in the church or at the thing, which was the legal council. And speaking of monarchs, the system of hereditary monarchy was not at all as ubiquitous throughout Europe as you might think. In many places, there was an election of a king, though the nobility was generally the only ones who had any voting rights. There was also a general understanding that the people had a right to overthrow the king if he didn't rule correctly. And of course, that happened a lot of times. And this shouldn't be overly romanticized either. This was basically just a formality. Most of the time, the one that was chosen to be the king was the son of the earlier king. And basically, the ones who overthrew kings were the ones who had armies to do it. It didn't really have to do with, the people's right to overthrow the king. But the principle was there, at least. There were, of course, periods of immense suffering during the time of the Middle Ages, such as the Black Death, the Crusades, and the Albigensian Genocide, sometimes called the First Genocide. However, these have defined our view of the Middle Ages to a degree I find completely out of proportion. For example, the 1500s and 1600s were way more filled with religious wars, religious strife, than the Middle Ages, but they were not referred to as a Dark Age. So we might want to revisit our view of that period as a period only defined by stagnation and barbarism, which I would argue it was not. When we move on to the period of colonization and imperialism, there are a number of different mythologies and legends to keep in mind. Firstly, the discovery of America by Europeans was not based on Columbus realizing that the world was round, but you probably knew that, but rather a gross miscalculation of its circumference. He was also not the first European to discover the Americas, but I suspect you knew that as well. There are many other narratives and counter-narratives as to how colonization went, such as the American idea of the Pilgrims coming to Plymouth Rock and things like that, but I will focus more on some other characterizations that have been historically very relevant, especially regarding the Spanish colonization. I will start with the so-called Black Legend, which is a tendency to portray the Spanish as exceptionally cruel colonizers. This was, of course, not completely untrue, since there were many great atrocities committed towards its natives. However, the rival empires, especially the English and Dutch empires, would portray the Spanish as especially cruel and barbarian, often tinged with anti-Catholic sentiment. Like, it would be very similar to anti-Semitic stereotypes that they would murder children and drink their blood. And yeah, it would be exaggerated cruelty, maybe not even exaggerated in scope of suffering, but in cruelty, definitely exaggerated. And of course, this also led to a counter-narrative that was popular in nationalist Spain, for example, where we can talk about a white legend where they whitewashed all the colonial crimes. And any time anyone would bring up the crimes of the Spanish colonial empire, they would just say that it was part of the black legend and propaganda. So it's important to realize that these things also have an impact on the way we view history. And there might not always be complete lies as well. That's the annoying thing, that everything that you need to watch out for is not just lies, it's certain accenting of certain events and downplaying of other events, like, for example, downplaying of British or Dutch crimes of colonization. And these conflating ideas and monopolar interpretations of the past has led to a tendency to either dehumanize the natives as barbarians or, conversely, simplify the situation and portray, for example, the Aztec Empire as comparatively peaceful and pacifist, which it was definitely not. This has, of course, made nuance harder to get at, and it makes our view of history ever more distorted. In my view, this sort of simplification of the pre-Columbian American peoples is also dehumanizing, and it reduces their complex and varied societies to either barbarians or as victims of colonization and nothing more. They aren't really viewed as people if we view it through this lens. And I think it's important to realize that there were complexities in these societies, just like ours. For example, one of the reasons the Spanish managed to conquer the Mexica Empire or the Aztec Empire was that many of the subject peoples of the Aztecs were not happy with the Aztecs ruling them, and they would join with the Spanish against the Aztecs. Moving on, we approach myths of national birth, and I'm not here talking about myths in the religious or pseudo-religious sense, like the gods coming down from Mount Olympus or something like that, but rather actual history, but distortions of actual history. One example can be found in my own country of Sweden, where the noble Gustav Vasa fought against the cruel Danish King Christian, who had so brutally slaughtered almost 100 people at the bloodbath of Stockholm. This is enhanced by a number of stories of his daring escapes from the Danish forces and how noble countryfolk protected him. There's also a story of how he was caught up by skiers from Dalarna in order to lend their support, today commemorated in Vasaloppet. Vasaloppet probably actually did happen, but most of this is also fictitious or heavily embellished storytelling, and it's very difficult to corroborate these stories of daring escape. Except for Vasaloppet, which might actually have happened somewhat historically. Gustav Vasa's forces were also heavily backed by mercenaries from Lübeck, which of course hurts the idea of a Swedish uprising against the Danish tyrant. And the legend of Gustav Vasa is today in Sweden mostly taken as that, as a legend, rather than as actual history. And it isn't really taught in schools, or at least the good ones, in my opinion. And Gustav Vasa is mostly viewed as a clever schemer, a clever king, a competent man, but also ruthless and opportunistic and cunning. Not unlike Machiavelli's ideal of the perfect ruler. And of course, this image has been slightly or heavily muted in traditional historical Swedish history writing, but it is coming through more and more. And of course, America also has a mythologized origin story, even with sort of semi-saintly backstories of some of its founders, such as the boy George Washington, who wouldn't tell his father a lie. So this is not unique to Sweden or America. It's very, very common to have these sort of mythologies of national birth. And for many nations, this is more difficult because they don't really have a successor state, or they're very new states and new creations, such as many of the former colonies in Africa and Asia. So they have to stretch back to maybe a historical empire or another historical people in order to have their myth of national origin. This can be seen, for example, in the naming of the state of Ghana, formerly the Gold Coast, which was named after a previous empire called the Ghanaian Empire, but it didn't actually share any land with the current state of Ghana, but they still called back to this great African empire. And also Mali is named after a previous empire, although that makes more sense because it's roughly in the same area. And some groups have, of course, had to create this this story without a state, such as the Assyrians, the Kurds, and the Roma. So that makes it even more difficult to create this sort of story of a national origin. But that exists in societies like that as well. Moving on to the last couple of centuries, we have some more mundane images of the past that have been tweaked for the sake of national romanticism. In Sweden, we have a clear example of this in the celebration of Midsommar, the relation to the movie. The Swedish tradition of Midsommar is seen as something ultra-Swedish in Sweden, but there is also a caveat to this characterization. For example, the traditional Midsommarstång is likely an import from Germany, and the food that we eat on Midsummer's Eve is mostly pretty newly created as a tradition. It used to be like porridge, but now it's herring and fresh potatoes. And the Midsummer bonfire, which is actually an older tradition, has mostly died out. And even if it's common in some of our neighboring countries, it doesn't really exist in Sweden anymore. And the view of a true Midsummer, how it should be celebrated, has mostly been just a copy of the regional celebration in Dalarna, which has become a standing for all of Sweden. And Småland also has some of this role, due to a number of literary works and other factors that sort of center Småland as the picture of Sweden, how it used to be. And of course, Dalarna has that image as well. And finally, I will shortly comment on the movie Midsommar, which of course doesn't really try to portray the actual Midsommar celebration. It's not really fair of me to criticize it in that way, but I will comment on the legend of the Ättestupa. And of course, it's just a legend. Ättestupa has long been referred to as places where the elderly went to die when they outgrew their use, but it is today recognized that this is almost certainly just a myth and a legend. And there isn't really any ancient sources corroborating their existence at all, except for stories that were written hundreds of years after this practice supposedly died out. But there is still places where you can ask people and they will say, oh, that's the Ättestupa of this village or something like that. But it is a legend more than history. And as a final example of myth-making, I would like to point to the Nazi German state, which sounds weird because it, of course, was destroyed more or less completely. But the images of the Nazi government actually continued to live on. Even if we view the Nazi government as a brutal dictatorship most of the time, there is also a weird overestimation of the capabilities of the Wehrmacht, and that is very, very common. The Wehrmacht is often depicted as having revolutionary weapons and very high-tech things, such as the Tiger tank or the STG-44 rifle. But these were all late war weapons that were produced when the war was already lost, basically. And they had very little to do with the invasions of France or even of Russia. And in fact, most German troops went to battle with rifles similar to those of the First World War, repeater rifles, Mauser rifles. And the idea that the technologically advanced German army made a stunning victory due to these super weapons is mostly actually a myth. It isn't really corroborated by history. It is more true to say that a very desperate Germany pulled in a lot of resources that could have been used elsewhere into super weapons that they hoped would create a shift in the balance of the war, but this was a desperate attempt and it wasn't really based in reality. And I also find it interesting that it still remains the image of the German army to this day, that they had very advanced weapons that were vastly superior to the Allies, which just wasn't true to any great extent. And even the idea of the Blitzkrieg is kind of an after construction, because although Germans would talk about Blitzkrieg, that was actually not a World War II doctrine. It was a doctrine from earlier, from like First World War or even earlier. And it wasn't a specific doctrine to World War II. It was just that they had, radios and things like that that made mobile warfare simpler. And I think this is speculation on my part, but I think that one of the reasons for this idea, why this idea has persisted, is that the British and the French, probably mostly the French, needed some excuse as to why they were so bad at fighting back the Germans at the start of the war. The French actually had better tanks, for example, than the Germans, by most estimates. But if we talk about, you know, the German army was so technologically advanced, how could we possibly have resisted? Then it sort of puts off the blame to another side. There was nothing they could do, right, against this mighty enemy. Yes, so that are the few examples that I decided to bring up. I hope you found it interesting. There are, of course, a lot of others, but I chose these ones as a sort of illustration of how history is made. Please leave a comment or retweet or give it a like. And hopefully I will see you all soon. Goodbye.